From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Philly is fit for the Fall Classic, but will they face the cool comeback kids from the hub of the universe or the hot nine from the Big Guava? Ahead on Only a Game, Tim Kirchin previews the 2008 World Series. Also, the storm clouds dissipate in Seattle and roll into Oklahoma City, home of the NBA's Thunder. And a conversation with Sports Illustrated's Gary Smith, author of Going Deep, 20 Classic Sports Stories. Also ahead, learn why pickleball practitioners feel their sport is a barrel of laughs.
I became majorly addicted to pickleball, and you meet so many wonderful people, and you have fun, and you don't have to dress a certain way. You just have to have clothes on. We don't have new pickleball.
Stay tuned, Major League. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Perhaps you think the Rays deserve an autumn shot at winning. They've almost always come in last since their obscure beginning. But as Game 6 begins tonight, all Tampa fans must feel some worry that on Thursday, Tampa couldn't close the deal. Joining me now to discuss what's most recently occurred in the League Championship Series, as well as what's likely to happen next tonight in Tampa, is ESPN's Tim Kirchin. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. We know few people, Tim, who have as strong a grasp of baseball history as you do. You were present at Thursday's game at Fenway Park. Boston went into the seventh inning down 7-0. What was it like to witness the greatest rally in 79 years of postseason baseball?
It was unbelievable, Bill, and I sat in the stands with my colleague Peter Gammons, which I never do, but he had an extra ticket, so I actually got a look at what the fans were thinking, and trust me, Bill, they were completely resigned to the fact that they were going to lose that game. They knew it in the third inning, they knew it in the fourth, and they were sure of it in the fifth inning, as well as the sixth and seventh. And then, out of nowhere, the Red Sox staged what is really the greatest comeback ever in an elimination postseason game. No team had ever come back from more than 5 runs behind in any elimination postseason game. They came from 7 runs behind. And I'm telling you, Bill, when you were there, it was like they were 17 runs behind. That's how far behind they seem to be. And then it happened so quickly and so miraculously. And before I knew it, I was on a plane going to the next destination, not the destination I thought I'd be going.
Well, Thursday night's game certainly demonstrated that the Red Sox have not forgotten how to come back from a deficit in a postseason series. You don't suppose they'll win the next 2 games in Tampa, though, do you?
I don't think they will, Bill, but I'm starting to wonder now. Again, when you've just witnessed something that nobody has ever seen before. People asked me after the game, have you ever seen that? And my answer was, no one has ever seen that. So I still think the Rays are going to win the series, and I think they're going to win it in Game 6 because they have James Shields, who they call Big Game James. He's their best pitcher. He pitches much better at home than he does on the road. He pitched very well against the Red Sox in Game 1 of this series. So I expect him to win. I expect this to be over. But after watching Game 5, I'm not sure I know anything anymore.
Tim, Big Game James and various other assets notwithstanding, have you been one of the many people following baseball this season, delighted by the spunky little ball club in Tampa, but somebody who kept thinking that at some point that ball club would fall to earth?
I did. I thought there's no way they would keep this up after April. I thought there's no way they could keep it up in the second half. And I even wondered, are they going to collapse down the stretch in September? As it appeared briefly, they might. But I can tell you this now, Bill. I don't care what happened in Game 5. I am a total believer in the Rays. They are young. They are athletic. They are energetic. They are really talented. And their manager makes sure they know exactly where they are and exactly what they're doing. And I can't tell you how impressed I am with the way these kids operate. Evan Longoria, the third baseman for the Rays, acts like he's been here for 10 years, and he's been here for 10 minutes. It's unbelievable how mature he is, as well as some other guys in that lineup. They have done just a fabulous job putting that team together this year.
What about the Phillies? I know you thought the Cubs would win the National League pennant. How many other National League teams did you figure to finish ahead of Philadelphia?
Well, I actually had the Phillies as the second best team in the National League playoffs. I really believe that if they could get their middle of the order going and really start to score some runs, they could beat anyone, I thought, except for the Cubs. As it turned out, they still haven't gotten their middle of the order going the way they would like, and yet they're already in the World Series. They've done it with a great bullpen. They've done it with a number one starting pitcher in Cole Hamels, and they've done it with offensive contributions from people that they're just not supposed to get it from. Shane Victorino, this little Hawaiian center fielder, has been their best hitter. They got three hits in one game from Brett Myers, who is a terrible hitting pitcher. He's the only player in the history of the postseason to get three hits in a postseason game, having batted under 100 for the season. And yet he beat the Dodgers with his bat one day.
Hey, what did he have, four hits in the regular season, like that?
He was 4-for-58, and then he went 3-for-3 in one game in the postseason. Again, Bill, this can only happen in baseball.
Given all the potentially intriguing World Series matchups when these playoffs began, Chicago against Chicago, for example, or the All-Los Angeles series, or the Dodgers with Manny against Boston with former Dodger J.D. Drew, what, if any, intriguing subplots are apparent in Philadelphia against Tampa or Philadelphia against Boston?
Well, Philly-Tampa will be fascinating because, again, the Rays won 66 games last year, and at this moment they have 103 wins. I mean, that's remarkable in itself. Just having the Rays in the World Series makes it a great, great story. And the Phillies haven't won the World Series since 1980, so we've got something going there for sure. Boston-Philadelphia certainly would be interesting because of the close proximity and everything else, but clearly when you talk to the TV executive, they were looking for something more than this. They really wanted the Chicago's or the Cubs in some form, or in the end, Boston against L.A. so Manny Ramirez could go back to Boston. So I'm not sure the TV executives will be real happy with whatever matchup, especially Tampa Bay-Philadelphia, but please, let's not underestimate the story of the Rays. It's the best team story in baseball, certainly since the 1969 Mets.
Tim, I hate to do this to you again, but I'm sure you can see it coming. Who wins?
I think the Rays are going to win this series over the Red Sox, and then I think they're going to beat the Phillies in seven games in the World Series. And don't take that to the bank. I've acknowledged how wrong I've been many times this year, but that's what I think is going to happen. I think this Rays wave is going to ride right through the end of October.
Tim, be assured that the bank is the last place I'm taking either imaginary or real money these days.
Good point, Bill.
Tim Kirkjian writes and talks about baseball for ESPN, and he joins me frequently on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
On Tuesday, the NBA team formerly known as the Seattle Supersonics and recently renamed the Oklahoma City Thunder played their first and only preseason home game to an enthusiastic crowd of 16,000. The New Orleans Hornets enjoyed two successful seasons in OKC after New Orleans Arena was KO'd by Hurricane Katrina, but some wonder whether there's room for a full-time pro franchise in the Midwestern oil town that loves its big-time college football program. Only a Game's Greg Eklund has the story.
All right, Thunder fans, on your feet, and let's welcome your Oklahoma City Thunder!
The common expression around here is, it will take some time. Time for a new name to catch on. Time for a team that won barely more than 20 games last season, before it was shipped from Seattle to the Midwest, to improve. And time for Oklahoma fans to accept the Thunder's best player, Kevin Durant, who's a former Texas Longhorn.
Number 35, Kevin Durant!
Of all the jersey numbers worn by fans in Tuesday's preseason home opener, the one most often seen was Durant's 35. One of those was Mike of Oklahoma City, who preferred not to reveal his last name, perhaps out of fear.
Yeah, I'm nervous, you know, because I'm a Sooner, and he came from Texas, so I'm kind of dealing with it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
I get a sense that a lot of people are dealing with that. Would that be accurate?
Yes, indeed.
Meanwhile, the Thunder are dealing with the task of creating their own niche in a sports marketplace traditionally dominated by University of Oklahoma football. Ferris Tayar, an Oklahoma City fan wearing a Sooner shirt, says that despite the recent arrival of an NBA franchise, it's still no contest.
The whole state of Oklahoma's loved OU football for about, 50 or 60 years. So until the Hornets start winning, maybe they might be bigger. But for right now, probably OU football.
Did you know you said Hornets?
No, I did not know that. The Thunder. until the Thunder start winning. Sorry about that.
Though the Thunder is the first professional sports franchise to permanently root itself in Oklahoma, it's generally accepted in this part of the country that the major franchise has always been and always will be Oklahoma Sooners football.
Check out the official online auction at Soonersports.com for authentic Oklahoma memorabilia direct from the OU Athletics Department.
While the Thunder were busy losing to the Los Angeles Clippers at the Ford Center in downtown Oklahoma City, Sooners head coach Bob Stoops held his weekly call-in show 30 minutes away at a Norman, Oklahoma restaurant.
The real OU fans, we wouldn't want another head coach. You're the best head coach in America.
No, and, don't say that. I never say anybody's best, but
well, that's the way we feel about it. That's the way the true OU fans feel about it.
Sooners fans stewed after OU's 45-35 loss to the Longhorns last weekend in the Red River Showdown. But Kevin Durant, last year's NBA Rookie of the Year after just one season at Texas, reveled in the Longhorns' win.
You know, I'm glad we came out with the win. I watched the whole game. I was excited the whole game. And, you know, it was a great game between two great football teams.
That sort of diplomacy will win fans for Durant and the Thunder. But if Durant averages more than 20 points a game this season, as he did for the Sonics last year, he'll be the most well-accepted ex-Longhorn in Oklahoma history.
I hope so. And I'm glad I'm here, you know, even though I went to Texas and, you know, we kind of hate Oklahoma, but I'm glad I'm here and I like the city so far.
Thunder coach P.J. Carlesimo knows his team needs to be better than its 22-60 record of last season. To do that, Durant will need plenty of help. But along the way, Carlesimo feels confident the Thunder will have the backing of the fans. 5 days after 13,000 season tickets went on sale, they were sold out.
You know, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind how special it's going to be. And again, we got to do it. Same way the team's got to play. The crowd's got to play, too. But I'm going to be shocked if we're not, like, right in the top two or three in the entire league of the 30 buildings, counting Staples twice. This is going to be one of the best buildings in the league. The other teams will tell you that.
8-year swingman Desmond Mason calls himself the Oklahoma Magnet. He played college basketball at Oklahoma State, then returned to Oklahoma when the Hornets temporarily played here. Now, after an off-season trade, he's back with the Thunder. His teammates rely on him for directions around the city. Mason says he has a different feeling at the start of this season than he did during his years with the Hornets.
We got tremendous support when I was here with the Hornets, but it's just a little bit different now. And I can kind of feel that from being in both positions. But, you know, I really enjoyed my time then, and I'm loving my time here now.
After the Hornets' 2-year stint and the Thunder's lone preseason home game last Tuesday, the dress rehearsal is over. Oklahoma City is ready for the long term. The city is moving forward with plans to upgrade the Ford Center. A new practice facility will be built on the northern edge of town. The Thunder will play its first regular season game on October 29th against the Milwaukee Bucks. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Oklahoma City.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The recent London Royal Parks Foundation inaugural half marathon lacked a tortoise. Otherwise, how could a hare have won? Actually, it was a white rabbit finishing in front of the other 1,200 runners in the race, and no surprise once you understand that the runner wearing a big white rabbit's head was Kenyan middle-distance champion John Muridi, who hopes to win a gold medal at the London Olympics in 2012. The Kenyan wore the rabbit's head at the behest of a sponsor, Nokia's Woodland Creatures, and said of the experience, "I liked the cheering and enjoyed being a rabbit." I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game this week's news with Charlie Pierce. But first, joining me to discuss college football is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Bill.
Last week, Texas, currently number one, knocked Oklahoma off the mountain, 45-35. How do you figure that's sitting with the Sooners?
Well, it hurt the Sooners because they really felt they were positioned to play for the BCS championship. They're undefeated. They had a great quarterback in Sam Bradford. And they went down to the big game against Texas, the Red River rivalry, they call it. They don't call it the shootout anymore, I think, to encourage no shooting between the fans. But they played at the Texas State Fair, and they split the stadium up. It's a big game, 45,000 fans on one side, 45,000 on the other. Normally, Oklahoma wins that game because they're mentally tougher, and they outlast Texas, which often has a lot of talent but doesn't bring it together. This was a game where Texas beat Oklahoma at their game. Not only was it a tough defeat for the national championship purposes, mostly takes them out of the running, it was also a very tough defeat to a big rival in the way that they lost the game.
Penn State is 7-0, currently ranked number 3, and there's already been some discussion of the Nittany Lions maybe contending for the national title, but Joe Paterno has a history of going undefeated and then not vying for the championship, doesn't he?
Joe Paterno has had an undefeated team in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. And at 82 years young, in the last year of his contract, he has a chance to have another one this decade. You never say never in sports. That will never happen again. Is someone going to have an undefeated team in five consecutive decades? He's, I think, had six times he's had undefeated teams, and he's only been awarded two national championships. If Penn State goes undefeated this year, I would certainly expect them to make it to the title game because there won't be three undefeated teams. Texas and Alabama that are ahead of them will probably lose at some point. They have much tougher schedules from here on out. But the real story is that an 82-year-old guy who has a hurt leg and has to coach from the press box, and the school basically wants him gone and doesn't even have him under contract for next year, has a chance to win the national championship.
Speaking of Penn State, they play Michigan today. The Michigan team is unranked. What happened to the Wolverines this year?
Well, Michigan had a new coach. They got the West Virginia coach, Rich Rodriguez, and it has been an unmitigated disaster from the start here. And it was punctuated by a loss to the mighty University of Toledo Rockets last week in the Big House, which would be one of the worst losses in the history of the University of Michigan. Although I'm sure that the Glass City celebrated like never before in Northwest Ohio.
Michigan's arch nemesis Ohio State has dropped in the rankings, and now they'll be without star defensive end Lawrence Wilson. Does this mean we'll be spared a third consecutive poor showing in the BCS title game?
Nobody wants to see Ohio State in the national championship game except for Ohio State fans. The last 2 years have been blowout losses. There's really suspicions about how well they play in the big game. They do very well beating up on fellow Big Ten competition. But when they get against a good team outside of the Midwest, they're usually non-competitive. So I think the pollsters who will basically determine who's going to play in the title game will hold that against them. So I don't think we're going to see Ohio State play again for the title this year.
As I glance at this week's national rankings, something I do each morning with my morning coffee, I can't help but notice that Ball State is among the top 25, albeit number 24. Is the school best known as David Letterman's alma mater about to become better known for its football program?
Probably not, but they are having a great season. They defeated in-state Indiana, and I know Letterman was and his worldwide pants were quite happy. However, it's good. They have a very good team, veteran team, good young coach. Not something that's going to be sustainable for the long term, but these are the glory days for Ball State.
There are, of course, too many teams to talk about in 6 minutes, but which team or teams that I haven't brought up would you like to discuss?
Anytime you're talking college football, the discussion kind of has to center down south. And, you know, I think Alabama is a team that still has a tough road to go. But in Nick Saban's second year would be, you know, at the mid-season point, positioned very well to make a play for the national title. Florida is coming along. They lost the game to Ole Miss earlier, but played very well last week. They're going to be a team in this thing. And I don't think you can count out Southern California, loaded with talent. If they can avoid another slip-up, they're going to be in this thing right to the end also. So what we're basically going to do, you and I, I'm sure we'll talk in about a month, and it'll be almost all chaos. Many teams will lose again. There'll be no clear decision on who's going to play for the title. and there'll be controversy, anger, wild message board postings on the internet, and all sorts of the normal bloodshed for college football that makes it such a frustratingly wonderful pursuit.
Well, let's stick to today for the time being. Have you a particularly dandy matchup that people should pay attention to this afternoon or this evening?
Well, I think you go right back to Texas. Texas has a four-game stretch here, starting with that victory over Oklahoma where they play ranked teams all the way. And today they play University of Missouri, comes in off of a loss, but a terrific offensive team. If Texas can run this table, they will be the most deserving team to play for the national title. They have probably the hardest schedule in college football right now. So I think the eyes of the country will be on the eyes of Texas for the next month as long as the Longhorns keep winning.
Dan Wetzel covers a multitude of games for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Hey, thank you.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. Going Deep is a collection of 20 stories written by Gary Smith and previously published in Sports Illustrated. In a sense, they are sports stories, since they are about people like Muhammad Ali, Mia Hamm, and Tiger Woods, and about games like baseball, basketball, and football. But in a larger sense, Gary Smith's stories demonstrate the writer's determination to discover and to communicate what makes the people he encounters who they are, not merely excellent athletes, but intriguing individuals operating in worlds far more complicated than the sports page generally acknowledges. Gary Smith joins me now from Charleston, South Carolina. Gary, welcome to Only a Game.
It's a pleasure to be here, Bill.
How did you go about deciding which of the many stories you had written should be collected into this book?
Well, I guess it was pretty generally agreed that I should put four stories in there that have won the National Magazine Award for Best Magazine Story of the Year, sports or otherwise. So those four are in there, and then there's three in there that... one that a movie's been made of and two others that movie rights have been bought on. And then beyond that, it was just kind of like, let's find a nice mix of the known and the unknown. And sometimes the known is actually unknown, as I've seemed to have found out through many years of doing this.
In 1996, Sports Illustrated published your story about Richie Parker, high school student who assaulted a 16-year-old girl. Many people who knew Richie Parker were shocked that he had done it. He had been regarded as not only a top-flight college basketball prospect, but as a quiet and well-behaved young man. Was that an especially difficult story to tell?
Really complicated. It just kept spiraling and spiraling, and that it was so complicated that it just kind of occurred to me, like, let's just take this and go layer by layer by layer, even to the layer of the journalist who was covering it and breaking stories week after week that were causing the colleges who were getting involved and the coaches who were getting involved and trying to recruit him, those coaches to get fired, the colleges to get in deep hot water, and just like what was propelling the reporter, just every aspect of it, just try to take it and peel layer after layer after layer and look at it and just see how these phenomenons get moving, the whole dynamic of a phenomenon like that.
The tension in that story comes from the fact that the people who feel that he should be in prison and should not get a chance to play college basketball because of what he's done, their feelings are precisely as powerful as the people who feel that we have to give people a second chance.
Yeah, it's a classic ethical question to spin around on, and that's what... kind of wanted to create a debating table and just feel like everybody was at the table and there's, you know, valid points of view on all sides. Let's kind of get it out on the table and give society a chance to look at itself, because a lot of this stuff kind of goes on unconsciously. And if you can bring it to consciousness, then maybe we begin to get a little better grip on it.
Do you think that the athletes about whom you write, and I'm thinking now especially of private people like Mia Hamm and Mark Fidrich, do you think that they know what they're in for when they agree to be the subject of a Gary Smith story?
You know, that's a good question. I try to make them aware, and usually they have agents or people around them who have some idea, and I try to make it a consenting adults kind of situation. And so I really try to make clear, there's going to be a lot of detail. I'm going to be, you know, it's very detail driven. It's going to be, you know, take a lot longer than anything else I'm sure you've ever done. And, you know, if they don't want to sign on, then I'm fine with it. I understand that. Usually, you know, once they're in, enough of a relationship builds up that that they seem to go along for the ride. And, you know, it's hard to say. Some of them I've had contact with afterwards to know, and others I haven't. So I don't always know. I'm sure it's, you know, it's a strange thing to suddenly have someone looking in that close.
Well, there's a refrain in that story about Mia Hamm. You keep having Mia intrude in the middle of the story and say something like, couldn't this just be a four-page story? Couldn't it just end here? Do you have to really tell that? Do you suppose that Mia Hamm laughed when she read the final draft of The Secret Life of Mia Hamm?
I'm sure she laughed, cringed, was aghast at times, she chuckled. You know, I can't even imagine what it was like for her to read that. And usually I wouldn't kind of intrude with that kind of thing on the story, but in this case it was so much a part of the dynamic of my relationship with her and that story and her concern that it felt like to me that it gave the reader an important window into her soul to kind of slide those lines in there.
Is there one particular story in Going Deep that stands out for you because you found out while working on the story stuff that caught you off guard or surprised you?
Andre Agassi, I just was a celebrity that of all the ones I've ever done, I was shocked at the way he jumped into it. First of all, I was shocked he was asking me as many questions as I asked him, and I've never had that happen from a celebrity. Celebrity usually is the answer to all questions in this country. And then once he couldn't figure out what I was kind of about here in this whole thing, and kept saying, you know, what aspect of the story do you want to write of me? Do you want to write about? And I said, you know, I want the whole shebang here. He scratched his head for quite a while, but once he finally realized where it was going, he jumped in with both feet, and he wanted to go on the exploration of who he was, you know, just kind of elbow to elbow right there with me. So that was just that was a great experience.
Of course, he already knew that he could cook a great steak, but that was something he had to prove to you.
Andre has proven that over and over and over again to many, many people.
I know this is a little bit like asking a parent to pick a favorite child, but in this collection of 20 stories, do you have a favorite yourself?
I think one of my favorites, definitely right up near the top, and also has the element of the character being a dear person who's remained in my life, is the one about John Malingoni. I mean, it's a story about a guy who was 5 years old in an Italian-American neighborhood in East Harlem, and the kids on the block decided to play, you know, make up an Olympics game. And so he threw a javelin that was a broomstick with a spoke from an umbrella tied to it, and it went into the head of his best friend who happened to be his uncle. And John was 5, and Uncle Orlando was 7. And Uncle Orlando died as a result of it. And John, the family decided to put a lid on it. So John never told a soul, not even his wife, his kids, until he was about 60 years old. And because of that, a guy that, you know, would have been an incredible baseball talent and tore up the minor leagues would just kept sabotaging himself out of the guilt. And anyway, it was just the story has so many twists and turns beyond the Cliff Note version I'm giving you here that, I mean, if I blew that one, I'd never, you know, be able to forgive myself because I just was continually astonished by the material, the things that John would keep bringing up, like, oh, by the way, like, oh, my God, that happened too.
Gary Smith is the author of Going Deep, 20 Classic Sports Stories, published by Sports Illustrated, and he spoke to me from Charleston, South Carolina. Gary, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's really been nice. Thanks, Bill.
You're listening to Only a Game. Among the listeners who appreciated Doug Trabue's recent story about the anniversary of Jose Feliciano's rendition of the national anthem at the 1968 World Series was Peter Murphy, who hears Only a Game on WBFO in Buffalo. It was one of the most moving pieces I've heard over the years, Mr. Murphy wrote. I often cringe at the mutilation of that beautiful song, both by those who choose poor variations and those who attempt to sing it in the traditional way and fall terribly short. I must say that Mr. Feliciano's version was one of the most beautiful, soulful, and respectful versions I've ever heard. It hit me deep in the heart, and I thank you for sharing it with us, your audience, some 40 years later. A WBUR listener identifying himself as Clayton J. emailed this week to comment on last week's discussion between guest host Anthony Brooks and Charlie Pierce regarding the latest misadventures of suspended Dallas Cowboy Adam Pac-Man Jones. If you are going to comment on the news, make sure you know something of what you're talking about, Clayton J. wrote. Jones's bodyguard was, in fact, hired to protect him from himself. Thus, it is perfectly understandable that he and Jones would get into a scuffle. The bodyguard was there to keep him out of trouble. By way of updating that story, yesterday Mr. Jones was reported to be considering programs for the treatment of alcohol abuse. He was suspended by the NFL indefinitely, but can apply for reinstatement after 4 games. Ed Bowen of Coral Gables, Florida, wrote this week to express his appreciation for our interview last week with Gary Fleeter, who directed The Express, the new movie about former Syracuse running back Ernie Davis. Having grown up an avid football fan, graduated high school in 61 in Oklahoma, I listened with great interest to your story about Ernie Davis, he wrote, and I will certainly see the movie. Actors, writers, or assistant directors who wish to thank us personally should contact us through our website, onlyagame.org. You can do that too, or you can write us at onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
As a participant in a conference discussing the potential effects of global warming, Professor Jan Bebbington wrote a speech set 40 years in the future. At least one of her predictions will be especially distressing to golfers with a sense of tradition. We have had to adapt to more flooding, coastal erosion, and rising sea levels, she wrote. We lost many historical sites on the coasts. For example, many of you will remember the sorrow at the last British Open played at St. Andrews. Beyond the loss of the old course to the sea, Professor Bebbington predicts Scots will move toward a largely vegetarian diet, a serious blow to lovers of haggis.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Pickleball. I'll say no more. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
What'd you call me?
The Boston Red Sox made history on Thursday night by staging the biggest postseason rally in nearly 8 decades. You think any Red Sox fans were awake to see it?
Well, let me tell you about one of them, okay, Bill? I was asleep. At about 7-0, I said, well, it's bedtime for the old man, and I went to sleep, and my son called me from Mississippi to tell me J.D. Drew had hit the home run to make it close. And I said, that's nice, Brendan. And I hung up the phone. I went back to sleep again. So if you're going to ask me any questions about that game, how the hell do I know?
Well, then let's look forward. The American League Championship Series stands at 3-2 in favor of Tampa Bay despite that unlikely win. They have 2 chances at home to send Boston to the golf course. What do you think? Will they do it?
Right now, I'll still say yes. I mean, playing in Castle Dracula is no fun in the best of times. There's a lot of pressure in Boston to pitch John Lester on short rest instead of Josh Beckett. That's silly. You're paying Beckett to win games like this. And the next one is the more important of the 2 games. And I think we'll go to 7. I really do. But I think somehow Tampa Bay will find a way to stumble across the finish line.
Game 6 of the World Series, if necessary, will be delayed by Barack Obama. Is this because he'll need time to warm up before starting for the Phils?
No, it's because the Cubs and White Sox are out and he doesn't care about baseball anymore, damn it.
I would think this could backfire. I mean, people tuning in to watch the game and seeing the last 8 minutes of a 30-minute Barack Obama commercial, it may change their votes.
I suspect not. They'll hang around and watch him and then watch the game. And I have a very sneaking suspicion that there'll be some reference made to the game during the infomercial.
The Major League Baseball Players Association claims that it has evidence that teams acted in concert to keep Barry Bonds off a Major League roster this season. Given Mr. Bonds' flagging talents, his reputation as a bad teammate, his pending trial for obstruction of justice, wouldn't collusion be superfluous in this case?
That's the only argument, is that they don't have to collude to find a good reason to keep him out, but that nonetheless doesn't convince me that they didn't collude anyway, because that's their nature.
The Dodgers were eliminated by the Phillies this week, Charlie, which means that Manny Ramirez, he of the $20 million salary, will not get to continue to collect playoff shares. Is that right?
No, he's going to get a two-thirds share from the Red Sox, which, considering that all we heard when he was traded from the Red Sox was how devastatingly awful he'd made their clubhouse, seems to me to be fairly generous, all things considered.
I love the idea that if the Dodgers had made the World Series and the Red Sox had, Manny could have been collecting on both ends. I mean, this is a gambler's dream.
That would be a 50-50, exactly.
The circumstance everybody's referring to as the current financial crisis has begun affecting leagues and franchises. Is it too early to characterize these days as hard times in the NBA?
David Stern says no, they've been losing jobs anyway. He says they cut the workforce a bit in anticipation of the slowdown. I think mostly the impact you're going to see are the people who are paying off arenas and so forth.
Another result of the economy's woes is that the Nets will be staying in New Jersey longer than their owner, Bruce Ratner, had intended. A lot longer, you think?
Yeah, this is exactly what I'm talking about. There was a $4 billion dream for a new arena in Brooklyn. That's not going to happen right now.
The NBA tried playing an exhibition game outdoors last Saturday night. How'd that go?
It got cold, actually, believe it or not, and it was in Indian Wells, California. They played in what is used usually for tennis there. And it was cold, and people didn't warm up, and it was a night game, and it was 77-72, which is a really ugly thing. And, you know, Phoenix won, and it doesn't really matter.
Some leagues have a mercy rule by which games automatically end when one team builds a ludicrous lead. Is it time to introduce that concept to high school football in Florida?
It was 91-0, Estero High School.
Ludicrous, I think.
They lost to Naples High by 13 touchdowns, and as one of the coaches of the losing team said, I didn't even know 91 was a multiple of 7. the other team only ran 31 plays. They kept some of the best players on the sidelines. Now, the coach on the other team is being ripped by both sides by saying he run it up, and he didn't run it up enough.
Right,
you just cannot win as a football coach.
Probably the only thing you can do in that circumstance is start taking some of your guys off the field and not replacing them. Like 11 against 10, 11 against 9.
The truly frightening thing is 91-0 wasn't even the biggest beatdown of the high school weekend. There was an Ohio game that went 96-0.
We talked a moment ago about how the current economic morass has affected the NBA. We should note that the NFL is offering ticket alternatives for fans as diverse as Joe the Plumber and CEOs rolling in government bailout money. What are those alternatives?
Yes, the winless Cincinnati Bengals are infusing new life into that old sports cliche, plenty of good seats still available. they're being sold below face value, and by the end of the season, maybe well below face value. At the same time, we're going to be seeing the first $1,000 tickets at the Super Bowl, which will not, by the way, in any way involve the Cincinnati Bengals.
The owner of the Atlanta Falcons, Arthur Blank, suggested this week that Michael Vick, the former Atlanta quarterback who's in jail presently for his activities in dogfighting, should return to the National Football League. Where does Mr. Blank think Mr. Vick should play?
Not Atlanta. Of course, it would be very interesting to see if Matt Ryan had turned out to be a bust instead of an arguable MVP candidate over the first 5 weeks of the season, whether Arthur Blank would be saying the same thing. He rolled the dice with Matt Ryan from BC and came up a natural. So right now he doesn't care where Michael Vick goes, and I don't think Michael Vick is going to press the case to come back to Atlanta.
A listener named Cy Solo, who hears the program on WLRM in Tennessee, wrote this week to say of us, I call you two frickin' frack. Should we feel good about that?
Well, there are other onomatopoeic words there that I'm glad he's not preempted by, but I got to say hi to Cy. Thanks for the email, and I hope to God they get rid of Phil Fulmer so you'll have an actual football coach at Tennessee now.
Charlie, some criminals are stupid, some criminals are unlucky. Is it fair to conclude that the guy who tried to snatch the pocketbook of one Janet Lane was both?
Hey, Janet Lane in 1953 won the Yorkshire Cross Country Championship. She's 68 years old. She ran the guy down and got her pension money back. Good for her.
Well, this week's news about how heavyweight boxer Vitali Klitschko keeps his hands from swelling give him an advantage when he next enters the ring?
Well, it certainly guarantees that I won't be shaking hands with him anytime soon. He wrapped his son's wet used diapers around his fists to keep them from swelling up.
Mm-hmm.
The nappies hold the liquid and the swelling stays down. Wonderful. Touch gloves, go get disinfected, and come out fighting.
And finally, in the waning days before the election that will determine the next mayor of Sacramento, California, candidate Kevin Johnson, a Democrat and former Phoenix Sun, has called on some help from ex-teammate Charles Barkley. Did the round mound of sound do his former teammate any good?
No, not at all. Charles checked in, said five of the biggest names in the Republican news coverage are all idiots, that neither party is anything to write home about, and that KJ was a great teammate and didn't pass the ball enough.
How can he lose? Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Frack.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear our program and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860, and you can visit our website, onlyagame.org. The names of our games are usually pretty self-explanatory. Basketball involves a couple of baskets. Baseball players run around bases. Football players use only their feet, unless they're American, in which case, well, like I said, the names usually make sense. Still, imagine our surprise when we discovered that the game called pickleball is played in the complete absence of any edible product, such as a cucumber that has been preserved and flavored in a solution of brine or vinegar. We dispatched Only a Game's Karen Given to investigate.
Barney, you got a minute? Nancy?
David Jordan calls together four members of the USA Pickleball Association's board of directors for a pre-tournament interview. They've got to take care of their media duties now because all four of them, including the tournament director, will be competing today. David is more likely to offer a welcoming hug than he is a handshake. Standing next to Public Affairs Director Fran Meyer, David happily takes on the task of introductions.
This is my wife, Nancy.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
And this is her husband, Barney.
Hi, Barney.
Pretty much we're the ones that have put it all together.
By this all, David is referring to the pickleball tournament at the National Senior Games Championship Festival in Smithfield, Rhode Island. Pickleball is a game very similar to tennis, played with a plastic wiffle ball and oversized ping pong rackets on a badminton court with the top of the net lowered to about 3 feet from the ground. It was invented on the Bainbridge Island estate of Congressman Joel Pritchard. But the bigger question is why? Barney Meyer offers his wife, Fran, for that answer.
She's a public affairs person.
Right, I made up the history. It appears that one afternoon the congressman went out to play golf with a friend. When he came back, the kids were all sitting around and they were rather bored. And so they decided to look in the garage, see what they had. They had some broken badminton rackets and they found a wiffle ball and they sent the kids out to play. And pretty soon they developed this game known as pickleball.
If you've been listening carefully, you'll realize that Fran has yet to include any references to actual pickles in her history. So why the strange name?
The Pritchards had a dog, and the dog's name was Pickles. And every time they hit the ball and it went astray, Pickles would run after it because, you see, it was Pickles' ball.
We're very thankful that it wasn't Bubba.
Pickleball was invented in Washington State in 1965, and Fran Meyer says in the last 43 years, the sport has spread to Arizona, Florida, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New York, Virginia, and...
South Dakota.
Oh, South Dakota. South Dakota the hotbed of pickleball.
As you might have guessed, David and Nancy Jordan are from South Dakota, but they didn't discover pickleball by sitting at home.
We are full-time RVers, and we were in Hershey, Pennsylvania one fine summer day, and I was out jogging, and there was a guy with a ball and a paddle hitting it up and down, so my curiosity got the best of me. I had to go see what he was doing. He said, "This is a game of pickleball. We're getting ready to play. Would you like to join us?" And it's been hooked ever since.
The Jordans winter in Florida, where some retirement communities have upwards of 100 pickleball courts for residents to enjoy. After their first introduction to the game, the Jordans spent the following winter playing pickleball at least 6 hours a day.
I fell madly in love with pickleball. And I would go with one group in the morning in 2 hours. We'd come home for lunch, and I'd go back for two more hours with another group and rest, and then go back for 2 or 3 hours in the evening. I became majorly addicted to pickleball. And you meet so many wonderful people, and you have fun, and you don't have to dress a certain way.
There's no all-white rule.
No, you just have to have clothes on. We don't have new pickleball.
Even though this event is put on by the National Senior Games Association, everyone's quick to point out that pickleball is not just a game for seniors. But Nancy and Fran agree that the small court and relatively slow ball have their advantages.
I see people walking by and they'll say, "Oh, this looks like fun. I thought I had to give up sports because I got this wrong with my knee, I got a hip replacement or some kind of problem." And he had a full knee replacement April 22nd.
And you're playing.
He's playing.
I'm playing. Yeah.
And he's got both hips replaced. And he's playing.
Yes, it's a very good sport with a questionable name.
It's a good sport with a stupid name.
Not even questionable.
That's the gist of it. It's a great sport, dumb name.
The comedy stylings of Bill Purdy and Wayne Tucker are constant in the single row of folding chairs that serve as spectator seating. But Bill and Wayne aren't simply spectators. They're a doubles team that's won just about everything there is to win in the 70 to 74 age group.
Most of the people we play have already died, you see. That's what's happened.
We intend to play until we die.
So. And are you going to win until you die?
Is the Pope Catholic?
Bill was a tennis champion back home in Scotia, New York, before he developed asthma and needed a smaller court. Wayne played racquetball 3 times a week for 35 years until he needed surgery to replace both knees. Now they use Bill's super-secret strategy to win pickleball tournaments.
Hit the ball one more time than the opponent in play.
0-0.
Roxanne Ware traveled from Brunfields, Texas, and has managed to find the only actual pickles in evidence in her USA Pickleball Association welcome packet.
Pickle pin to pin them on my clothes, pickle pin to write with, and a T-shirt, and an official rule book. And then they'll keep me current on all the new rule changes and all the new officials and all the events around the country.
Roxanne has been playing pickleball for 2 years inside, where she can escape the Texas heat and need for sunscreen. And she considers herself on the cutting edge of the pickleball revolution.
The most fun is when you watch the younger kids that are picking up the game. My grandchildren play with me. I have a little game set up at home. And they can't wait to play every day. And I can't keep up with them at all. They're so quick. But it's catching on across the country. All the schools and... it's really becoming the thing to do.
Purdy, Rohr, Meyer, and Meyer. Court one.
Many of today's players are decked out in shirts that say pickleball, a dilly of a game, or pickleball, the kosher sport. But the most popular option is the official shirt of the USA Pickleball Association, which calls pickleball America's fastest growing sport. Fran Meyer is wearing one, so I ask if she has any stats to back up that claim.
Are you sure it's the fastest growing
sport? Well, that's what your shirt says. Your shirt says America's fastest growing sport.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that we have the statistics. This is growing so fast that we can't keep up with the statistics. We have been trying to track the number of courts. I had maybe 21 different courts listed across the country. Now there are hundreds, and they're growing at an exponential rate. So I'm not sure I know of any other sport that's growing at that pace.
The number of sports claiming to be the fastest growing in the country is long. It's a mantle taken up by mixed martial arts, lacrosse, disc golf, paintball, and roller derby, to name a few. But if the fastest growing sport isn't pickleball, well, maybe it's best not to mention it. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Smithfield, Rhode Island.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti, and we had help this week from Erica Bailey. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's pickleball photo gallery, and who wouldn't, download our weekly podcasts or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Wayne and Betty Tucker on playing pickleball with the grandkids.
Well, he always wins. There's no doubt.
You don't even take it easy on the grandkids?
No, I play them lefty sometimes.
Yeah, well, what the ultra-competitive Wayne Tucker isn't revealing here is that he's actually a southpaw. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.